From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is an opportunity for you to get a half hour of commentary and analysis and sometimes even insight into the media issues of the week. I got a little maybe yes, maybe no signal from our producer, David Gustina, here. We'll see if there's insight. Thanks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Sir.
Hello, Rex.
And here we are with David, yes, with David Lombardo, who would be your son. Here we are with Barbara Lombardo. David Lombardo is a wonderful Times Union reporter. His mom, the former editor of the Saratogan and the Record, is now teaching and sitting here and talking to us.
Yes, I used to be Barbara Lombardo, and now I'm David's mom. Okay.
I'm sorry, I'll try not to introduce you next time.
Glad to be here.
Wonderful to see you. And Caitlin Brown, head of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose.
Hello.
How do? Great to see you. And so we are all here. Dr. Chartok, by the way, because of an injury, is standing, I think. Are you standing?
Yes. Well, you know, there are those people who think I'm so short, they can't tell when I'm sitting and when I'm standing.
That's really mean.
Ba-dum-bum.
Anyway, it's good to see you in whatever capacity you may be, Alan, and I hope your back feels better soon. Otherwise, you know, maybe you're just trying to feel smarter than the rest of us because being above us sort of has that.
Oh, yeah, you found me out.
Down on us. There you go. Well, it's a good thing. Anyway, we have some mail from a listener in Charleston, South Carolina. How about that?
That's super.
Since you can download the app and listen to WAMC anywhere. Rob in Charleston says, I'm a weekly listener to The Media Project, and I would like to ask you to discuss the coverage of Trump rallies. Actually, we dealt with this in passing a couple of weeks ago. Why is it that even MSNBC and NBC give him so much coverage, and you rarely see Democratic rallies? I'm sure that Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders, among others, are giving spirited rallies too, but I never see them. It appears that the mainstream media is falling into the same trap that they were in 2016, giving Trump millions of dollars in free advertising while shutting out the Democrats. Panel.
I think our listeners are absolutely right. We should not be providing so much coverage. But the problem is, if something newsworthy happens, the journalists need to be there to bear witness and share it with the people who were not in attendance or did not see the rally. So we have an obligation to be there as journalists. At the same time, we don't want to give him all those millions of dollars that our listener so rightly made mention of.
Yes, I totally agree. And not only is he getting free coverage, by having the snippets of ridiculous things that he is saying repeated and repeated and the people behind him cheering him, it inadvertently lends an air of credibility and believability to the things that he is saying. So
the
we're doing double damage.
Are not accurate, you're saying.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Damn. I agree with both of my fellow panelists here. And I hate to do that. Except I would point out that there may be a silver lining here. Silver lining is the more you play this foolish man on the television and on the radio, the angrier the Democrats get. And there are a number of indications that people are really ticked off. Number one, the Democrats, the first time that I can remember, are vastly outraising the money that rich Republicans are able to raise. Number one. Number two, I think that the energy level of the Democratic Party is now so great that we see registration, early voting, the pollsters being all wrong. And why are they all wrong? Because they can't figure out who's going to come out and vote. You know, I live with somebody who wants to throw something at the television every time she sees Trump's face on there. And she yells out things like, I hate you.
It probably makes her feel better, Alan.
Well, it does. It does. At the television. Well, you multiply her by a couple of million, and that might really affect the way in which this next by-election goes. And there's a very good chance, by the way, that you're going to see a huge turnout. Am I talking too long? Yes.
Back to the media issue at hand here, rather than the political one, please.
No, but the media issue is there.
But there is not a media intent here. And I would point out that, as we pointed out last week, even Fox News is no longer carrying wall-to-wall coverage of these rallies that Fox used to carry entirely. They are now even cutting away from. So even the president's favorite network, which is really sort of, you know, a closed system with the White House. But there is something to be said. He is the, number one, he is the president. And so that is different from somebody who is aspiring to be president. So you do pay more attention to the president if you're a journalist.
Except, Rex, let
number
me interrupt
two,
and say we do equal time.
No, we do not.
No, no. We do equal time on the president's weekly address.
Oh, yeah.
We give the Democrats a chance to respond, or if the Democrats are president, we... So I think that the earlier remarks by my distinguished panelists, fellow panelists, have put out there is correct. I mean, there should be that way to put a Bernie rally on or something.
But there are not, in fact, rallies like the president's rallies being done by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama. They are doing some political appearances, some speeches and the like, but they don't do mass rallies the way that the president does. And the president is more newsworthy, you know, when he goes out and does
I think that the media have an obligation to, as they're reporting what the president has said or the snippets of what the president has said or has said for the 100th time, to at that very point also say, but climate change is real. Scientists around the world
agree. In real time.
Or
yeah.
Whatever it is about immigration or whatever it is about women's rights, whatever the issue is, that he needs to be called on for not telling the truth in a way that the media have never had to do before.
Yeah, real-time fact-checking. Yeah, that's really hard to do. And
well, you could be ready, you know, we could be ready with our lists of retorts.
Well, I've actually seen them do it. I mean, I've seen CNN come on and say, the president just said, and that's wrong. And I mean, immediately, real-time, as it, you know, as it's happening.
Yep, I think you're exactly right. And I don't mean to say that I think that the media were faultless in the last election. That one of the ways that Donald Trump succeeded was because of the relentless coverage that he got, because he was so much more interesting, and all these cable networks just lapped it up, right?
Which is why we should stop talking about him now.
All right,
something
all right.
else.
Well, okay, let's go.
I think he's had enough attention.
Let's
on
go
this
from
program.
Him to another politician, and that's Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke, and his election. Now, he's got a ton of money. He's still running 9 points behind Ted Cruz in the election. But 9 points is nothing compared to an election we saw in Queens recently where the pollsters got it wrong by 50%. Please.
What's interesting about that is that we know all of this because the extensive media coverage about the races that are certainly being micromanaged by the press and micro-paid attention to because of the importance of the midterms.
Yeah, and one of the things I like about the coverage that I've seen about that race is how I've repeatedly seen the clips of what Cruz has said about Trump in the past, what Trump has said about Cruz in the past, and how you can't believe anything any of them say because they're going to say nasty things, and then they're suddenly in bed with each other.
Yeah, but you know, what's interesting is that CNN wanted to do a debate, so they invited both of them for an hour. Of course, Cruz, who is ahead, like all politicians who are ahead, say, I'm not doing a debate. And they said, okay, but then we're going to just have one person on, and they've been announcing it all day, every day, that they're going to have Beto O'Rourke on, and that they're not going to have Cruz on because he's not coming. He's decided not to come. That's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Well, what's also unusual is a single U.S. Senate race in one state getting this kind of nationwide exposure. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think Democrats hate Cruz. I mean, I think that's pretty soon.
They
hate him so much that they're sending a ton of money, more money than has ever been raised in a senatorial election, has gone to O'Rourke.
But CNN is fulfilling its job as a media outlet by providing listeners, viewers, readers, however they're getting their audiences, because I think they get those on all those platforms, with the opportunity to hear the candidates. Now, the fact that one of the candidates chose not to participate in a media endeavor that would have exposed him to probably more scrutiny and an interesting dynamic with his opponent, the voters won't have that opportunity to see them play out, but it should be an advantage for O'Rourke.
And that is something that has to be pointed out by the media itself. So I believe Rex's paper, The Times Union, shook its finger. Shook is the right word.
We did shake.
Shook its finger at the governor of New York and said, just because you're ahead, that doesn't mean you shouldn't debate your opponent. You should debate your opponent. The New York Times did it also. So that's another service that the media can provide by pointing out, you know, who's chicken and who's not and why.
Which, by the way, we think is not going to happen as we record this program, that we don't think there's going to be a gubernatorial debate in New York. We've tried. We tried to join with the League of Women Voters and get a debate, and I presume you did too at WAMC. Sure. But we were unwilling to do what CNN is doing. We decided we didn't want to have a debate just with the four challengers of the governor. It would be a real debate if the governor were there. But why would you have a debate for second place?
It's a great question, and it makes sense that one is not held without the governor.
Yeah, but it gives him the deciding vote, really, and that's not the way it should be. So you try to apply pressure, as you said, Alan, with your opinion pages and see if you can get him to come out.
Yeah, and you can report what those candidates are saying and their positions on things in writing, for print and online, without having the format of the debate. People who come to it tend to be the supporters of each party.
I think Rex just raised a very interesting point, which is in New York State, we have a Republican Party, Democratic Party. That's the way it's going to play out. But then we have an additional third party candidates. Should they be allowed in the debate? The League of Women Voters, I believe, has said, okay, if you're polling more than 5%, and I don't really know if this is what they do, but then you can be in the debate, otherwise you can't. We're a public radio station. When we're having our debates, people are demanding to come on, and we're letting them on, even though we don't particularly like it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting dilemma when you have a candidate who has no support. I mean, we all remember the gubernatorial debate that included Jimmy McMillan, the rent is too damn high party candidate. You know, there's a colorful character we only remember because Andrew Cuomo insisted that he wouldn't debate his opponents unless all of them were there, and Jimmy McMillan was on the ballot.
And where do you think he learned that from? He learned it from the guy I knew the best, who was Mario, who I, you know, interviewed once a week for a dozen or more years, who said the same thing. And in fact, I was greatly faulted, probably appropriately, for moderating that debate. And the cartoon, either in your paper, Rex, or the Schenectady paper, it's on my wall, showed Cuomo throwing, and it's a word we don't want to use, dwarfs against the wall because of the other guys.
Oh, yeah, that was when that was a controversy. There was legislation. Yeah, what do you know? Anyway, these political issues that have arisen, thank you to our listener in Charleston, South Carolina, Rob, for writing. You can share your thoughts with us, media@wamc.org, and we're happy to bring your comments in. The Media Project, Alan Shartok, Barbara Lombardo, Kaylin Brown, and I'm Rex Smith, and we're happy to be here with you. Dominating conversation about the media over the past couple of weeks has been the apparent murder of the Washington Post columnist, freelance columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, who wrote for the Washington Post. And this has become a big deal because of concern about how the United States government has responded or has not, because of the way the Washington Post has handled this. And the question is it appropriate, I guess, for us to have so much of American foreign policy hinge upon the apparent killing of a single person, a journalist? What is the role that a journalist plays, and why should it matter so much that one person has apparently been killed by a foreign government?
So maybe I could go first and say one of the things that a lot of people don't like about Donald Trump is that he has declared war on the press. We know that because he says the press is the enemy of the people, borrowing a term from Ibsen. So when he basically sides with the Saudis and says, well, we don't know, it's not been proven, even though the Turks believe that they have audio of him being killed and dismembered and tortured, the president of the United States, when they start to quiz him about it, he gets nasty with the reporters who are quizzing him about it. So I think it's entirely appropriate, considering the context that he has set up about how bad the press is. And one more thing on that, if I may, and that is, look, the press has done some things that I consider to be despicable. You take a look, I always say to Rex, look at the New York Post, look at this and that. And then what happens is, along comes Trump and he attacks the press, and as one, the media, probably appropriately, rises up. And you do this a lot, Caitlin. You say the press can do no wrong, but the press can do wrong.
Jamal Khashoggi devoted his life to writing about Saudi Arabia because he saw oppression of people. And the reason that journalists matter so much is because they talk about oppression and sure. try to identify wrongs and injustices in society.
Exactly.
In this particular instance, this is a human rights issue. The fact that it's a journalist, for those of us who have a deep interest in journalism, we can see that this is especially egregious, obviously. This is an effort to silence voices, especially a voice who was dissenting. Fortunately, the Washington Post was able to publish Khashoggi's last column very recently, in which what was the last thing he wrote about? The ability for people to speak freely and the value of his ability to be able to speak freely.
Because in many of these countries, like Saudi Arabia, as he wrote, citizens are either ill-informed or misinformed because there isn't freedom of the press. And the absence of information is really what is a peril to democracy. You can't have effective democracy if people are lied to or if the press doesn't get access to information, which is why, going back to the arguments about our president, which is why we need to be so aggressive about ferreting out his lies, because that is what leads to the demise of democracy.
But we know about his lies. The Washington Post adds them up. They're 2,000 lies, 3,000 lies, whatever it is.
4,000.
More than 4,000.
4,000 lies. So they do, so what? It's as if water is falling off the duck's back. This is the new normal. This is the way things are. So what? Oh, you know, who cares? This is not Alan speaking now. This is Alan talking about what certain people, particularly people in the Republican Party, are saying.
As far as Khashoggi, I really hope that the national media and local media do keep it alive. Don't bury this story. There's so many crazy things that keep happening in this administration and in the world. We cover it, and then we move on to the next thing, and we kind of forget to stay on top of the horrible thing that they're trying to distract us from remembering. And
there's so many topics that need our attention,
yes,
that it's hard not to get distracted.
And I think we have to keep telling readers, keep telling listeners every day what's still going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
And that's hard, and it is hard to do.
You know, it's interesting, Barbara. It came out in the beginning, and you got guys like Lindsey Graham, I don't like, and other people, and they were making it clear, Trump better not do this and not take this terrible murderer and put it under the rug. And then all of a sudden, that chorus of Republican senatorial voices has become dissipated and muted and more and more muted. Now it's up to the media, that's where it comes into the media, to point that out. Hey, Lindsey Graham, the first day you were irate. How come we haven't heard so much irateness lately?
Yeah, well, you know, I think his color is manila. He folds. It's just kind of ridiculous. He always gives up after huffing and puffing. Our point in an editorial on this topic was that what we don't know is whether the president's silence on this topic, you know, Donald Trump suggesting maybe rogue agents were responsible for the killing of Khashoggi,
sure,
which term I don't think was his own. I think that was put into his head because that's not Donald Trump's words. He would have said, you know, bad men. But rogue agents perhaps did this, he suggested, and maybe that's because he has financial stake in Saudi Arabia.
Big financial stake.
They have a big financial stake in him, certainly.
They take him bragging about, in during the election, all the money that he has been getting from the Saudis, and they play it on the tape. Now he gets up and he lies again, and he says, I don't have any relationship with him, any fiscal relationship with him at all.
Well, then do we not have sanctions, right?
I'm not arguing the point.
If the Crown Prince ordered a hit on a journalist who is a dissident, there should be sanctions by the United States.
And that's another good thing.
I know that's political, but...
That's another good thing that's going on. The press has been able to take all of those pictures of the supposedly rogue guys who showed up, and then they show pictures of them with the prince. Mm-hmm. So it's really something.
So there are all kinds of outfall of this. One of them is the Washington Post has this blog in which they have contributors, partisan contributors from around the community, the Post Partisan blog. So they have partisan. And one of them, one of their bloggers is a very powerful lobbyist named Ed Rogers. He's chairman of the BGR Group, which is a major lobbying firm. The Post has told him, if you don't drop Saudi Arabia as your client, you will not be allowed to write for us anymore. And that is, I think, entirely
appropriate. What do you think
about
that?
I think that is fascinating because the company for whom this lobbyist works is making $80,000 a month from the Saudi Arabian
government.
But
is it appropriate?
And they've determined they would not take any more money from Saudi Arabia while this crisis is unveiling and revealing itself.
Well, it's interesting, Alan, because for so many decades, we in the press have tried to say that we're going to present different points of view. You can be coming from different places. And now we're suddenly deciding which places you can represent, who you can be affiliated with. So in this particular example, I think it's an excellent move on the Washington Post part. But I see the issues because you can go more than one way on it. Turn the tables.
But journalism is something about values. Certain values have to be represented in your journalism. And if the preservation of human life is not a value, if you don't stand up and say, we're not going to have anything to do with you if you are an associate of murderers, which seems to be what is the case if you're an ally of Saudi Arabia in this case, I think it's entirely appropriate for the Washington Post to do this. So, anyway.
Well, it raises interesting questions about censorship. It truly does. And who gets heard and who doesn't get heard and who has the power to have access to audiences, just like this program right here. We have a big responsibility here. What we're saying should matter, and we should be very careful in our word choice and the ideas that we're choosing to share on this platform.
And think of this. I was out speaking at a public gathering at a civic event last week, and a guy came to me and was attacking me over something that Rosemary Armeo said on this program in January of 2017. And he actually then sent me a tape of it. Rosemary had made some negative comment about something that the president said in his State of the Union address. And this guy was attacking me for having not taken Rosemary to task when she was going through this long piece that she was talking about. So be careful, because we all will have guilt by association of things that each other says.
Oh, no.
I am not responsible for what Alan says.
Word.
Well, if you're just joining us, it's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith with Alan Chartok, Barbara Lombardo, and Kaylin Brown. And we thank you for joining us. Media@wamc.org is how you can reach us.
So during the fund drive, which we just got through very
big
successfully, a lot of people called up and said, the Media Project should be an hour. I don't want to start that all over again.
Oh, yeah, I don't want to start that all over again, let me just say. Oh, well, what can you do? We want to talk just a little bit before our time is up about college students. A new poll says that in a news media consumption study, almost half of the college students polled said they lack confidence in their ability to discern real news from fake news in social media, right?
Well, as Kaylin and I are both teachers in universities, I know that we both try to teach that in our classes. And one of the simplest things is, what's the suffix on the website that you're using? Is it an .com or an org? Is it an .edu? Is it a government site, which now I'm a little bit worried about what's going to be on the government sites and not be on the government sites? And which credible mainstream media outlets can they rely on? And we look at examples. And I can tell you that aside from maybe an obvious thing of an .edu for representing a college, it is difficult sometimes. What do you think, Kaylin?
Well, I think that we are fortunate that we're working with journalism students primarily. Also, I work with communication students, and so they have a higher sensitivity. I do think there's some value to all curriculums having some sort of news and information literacy programs. We've talked about this repeatedly.
That's a great idea.
It's important for students from a young age to understand what is reliable and what is not reliable information, and anyone can teach this in a classroom. It just requires an understanding of how information is gathered, how it is researched, reported out, collected, synthesized, put together, and made to sound understandable for audiences.
Actually, and if you are a teacher listening to this and you want some materials, Stony Brook University, you could go to
just Google Stony Brook University and literacy, civic literacy, you'll find it.
Right, exactly. It's the National Center on News Literacy at Stony Brook University has actually guides for teaching news literacy. It's a really great thing. So
look that up.
Do not hesitate. All right, that is the end of our time for now. Imagine that, because as Alan says, it's not an hour-long show. Alan Chartok, Barbara Lombardo, Kaylin Brown, and I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us on The Media Project.
Upon a living stage now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is chair of the Department of Communication at the College of St. Rose. And Barbara Lombardo is a journalism professor at the University at Albany and former executive editor of the Saratogian and Troy Record. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.